Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, ranked number one podcast by Canadian financial advisors in the 2021 Environics Advisor Digital Experience Study. Back again for his regular look at the markets and macro developments is Jurjen Timmer, Director of Global Macro. Jurjen shares some thoughts on recent movements in the market spurred by developments in China. He will also unpack the seasonal wobble that historically calls for a market peak in the first week of September before some volatility. Jurjen also discusses how much of an impact the U.S. presidential cycle may have on the markets, as well as looking at emerging markets, crypto, and tapering by the U.S. Fed. Today's podcast was recorded on September 27th, 2021. And as usual, please keep Jurjen's Twitter profile close by to follow along with some charts. And that's at TimmerFidelity on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects. I'm Pamela Ritchie. Historically, September is known for some weakness and volatility in the markets. It's been dubbed the September effect. So far this year, there's been some real truth to that. The markets are coming off a roller coaster week amid a series of concerning events, from the debt crisis in China's property sector to the Fed signaling on tapering and to Beijing's crackdown on currencies. So against this backdrop, where do the markets stand today ahead of the upcoming earnings season? And where are they poised to go in the weeks that follow? Helping us to unpack these questions and to discuss the relationship between price, supply and demand, we're very happy to be joined by Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, Jurjen Timmer. Great to see you, Jurjen. How are you?
Good morning, Pamela. Nice to see you again.
I wonder if we can ask you, first of all, just one question and somewhat get it out of the way. This is a big week for Washington. Do we need to worry about the debt ceiling conversation? Is it different this time?
I don't think so. The debt ceiling is one of these issues that people like to worry about, and it pops up every so often, but ultimately, the can always gets kicked down the road because it's kind of the laws of mutually self-assured destruction. So it will go away. They'll kick the can down the road maybe for 3 months or what have you. But it's an issue that people like to worry about, but it really never has come to fruition. In 2011, we did get that downgrade, but even then, ultimately it gets resolved.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you for sort of hitting that off the top. Let's go into ultimately what was said last week. We had Jerome Powell, essentially introducing the taper, right? We saw reaction in the markets. What did you think of the reaction in the market?
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit more of a hawkish tilt. But we all saw it coming. We've talked about this for weeks. If the Fed is going to start raising rates in 2023 or even late 2022, it better get on the taper soon because it needs to go from 120 billion zero in some sort of orderly way. And the thinking is it's going to be 15 billion a month, 10 treasuries, 5 mortgages. And they're going to reduce that, every month by 15 billion until they get to zero. And generally the thinking is that they don't start raising rates until they are done on the asset purchase side.
The first slide to reference is the Fed and the market, which was tweeted on September 30th.
So in this chart here, you see the new dot plot, and the new dot plot definitely looks more, up and to the right than the old dot plot. And now they've added 2024 dots, which again shows you a more linear path towards what they think the long term should look like. And then you see in that dark blue line is the Fed funds futures curve. the little blue dots is the euro dollar curve. So you can see that the markets are pricing this in, and you know the 10-year treasury yield is at 1.48 right now.
The next slide here, please take a look at fiscal and monetary policy, tweeted on September 30th. This will be followed by U.S. rates, also tweeted on September 30th.
You can see that the 10-year had been in a holding pattern for quite a while, but now is resolving itself in the upward direction. And, you know, it's not, I mean, it's understandable why this would happen, right? If you look at the bottom side of this chart here, kind of the hot pink bars that turn negative at the bottom there, that's the Treasury's balance at the Fed. So that's the TGA account, the Treasury General Account. So the Treasury's been running down its cash balance at the Fed to pay for the stimulus plan that came out, you know, in March. But that money is now gone, more or less. And the Fed has been obviously continuing its asset purchases. That's the blue line there. But that's now going to come to an end over the next, you know, let's say 13, 14 months if they start the taper in November. And so, you know, we're going to have infrastructure bills. We're going to have another potentially stimulus bill from the Biden administration, you know, the American Families Plan. That's going to include taxes, so it's not going to be all funded by debt. But still, there will be new debt right at the time where the cash is gone and the Fed is wrapping up its asset purchases. So it's just supply and demand. It's understandable why rates would be rising here, and that's exactly what they're doing. And actually, if we go to the second slide real quick, you can see that actually, so these are all the maturities from 30 years down to 3 months. And you can see that, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year treasury yields are actually already at new highs for this cycle, even though the 10-year and the 30-year are well below. So, this is fairly typical, right? It's called a bear flattener. And this is what you would expect to happen when the Fed is, you know, normalizing its policy.
It's fascinating. Okay, so bring into some of the stock market wobble that we've seen, you know, last week, but also, I mean, the China Evergrande discussion has been in the markets. We've seen this moves. We've seen equities wobble. Tell us how we should frame this.
It's pretty amazing. I think we didn't meet last week, but I think I may have shown this 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so let's take a look at seasonal pattern for U.S. equities, tweeted on September 27th.
And literally like clockwork, the market peaked exactly. And again, I think this is more coincidence, unless everyone is looking at this chart and then trading on it. But you know, that seasonal wobble, as I like to call it, would have called for a peak first week of September, and then a bottom last week of September. Guess what? That's exactly what has happened. And typically the roadmap for this, and actually if you look to the left of the slide, not all the way back to the lockdown, the pandemic crash, but to the right of that, exactly a year ago, we had that fall wobble again. And that was kind of a triangle, right? So you saw the high in early September, then the first low a few weeks later, then a recovery, and then a secondary low. And that is actually exactly the textbook occurrence for this fall wobble. So you get, it's kind of a two-part move. So we've had the first part where we went down 5%. We're well above that now. We broke down below the 50-day moving average. We're back above it. If history is any guide, and again, this is based on averages of 100 years of cycles, so history is never going to repeat exactly, although it did last year. But if it were to repeat, we would have a rebound like we're having now, and then the market will come down again and then sort of make a retest of last week's low somewhere first or second week of October. That would be kind of really the cookie cutter textbook fall correction. But you know, I would just say, just add to this, you know, we've been having this conversation for at least 6 months in terms of when we hit peak reopening, peak inflation, that, you know, the high flyers, the meme stocks, they peaked in January, you know, value stocks peaked, I think, in May. And we've been in this stealthy kind of correction. that is really invisible to the naked eye, just because large cap growth stocks have been, you know, painting the tape, to use an old term. But underneath it, the market hasn't really done anything for quite a while now, and that is very consistent with where we are in the cycle. So the fact that we actually have a wobble that we can see on the chart is really just kind of the icing on the cake for something that's already been happening for a while.
Fascinating. So let's go actually back to the discussion of the taper, back to the discussion of yields generally, what we've seen them do. You've mentioned there sort of the supply and demand of it all, but the nominal rates discussion comes back further into where we're sitting. Frame that for us.
Up next is Real Rates and the Fed, which was tweeted on October 1st.
So this is really the big question, I think, for the markets right now, because I have no doubt in my humble opinion that over the long term, the Fed will continue to play a role in the market. It will follow in the footsteps of the Bank of Japan. We've talked about that in the past. So over the next five, 10 years, I think the Fed will be in the market and real rates will remain suppressed at negative levels. Nominal rates will remain suppressed, you know, at low positive levels. But that doesn't help us over the next 12 months, because right now the Fed is going to taper. And it rightfully believes that that's the right thing to do, because the economy simply does not require, you know, the kind of emergency level easings that we've seen. But it does beg the question, like, what happens next, right? So in this chart here, I show you the 5-year real yield, and it is hovering at, you know, basically, multi-decade lows, minus 2%. Similar to where it was in the spring of 2013, when we actually had the original taper tantrum. And so if the TIPS break even market, which is signaling inflation in the low twos, and I think that the TIPS market is incorrect, that inflation probably will be higher than that, but that doesn't matter. The market seems to believe the Fed, or agree with the Fed, that inflation is going to be transitory, and that over the next 5 years or so, inflation is going to be maybe, you know, 2.25 or something like that. So if the Fed's taper now pushes nominal yields higher, which is what would be expected, and the TIPS break-evens don't move from here, then by definition, real yields will become less negative going forward. And you know, you just look at the chart. I mean, the last few years kind of look like to the left of the chart leading up to that taper tantrum. So if real yields become less negative in the months ahead as the Fed tapers, you know, what does that do to gold, for instance? What does that do to equities, right? I mean, if the discount rate in the discounted cash flow model starts to go up, that should be a negative for valuation. And, you know, if we go to the next slide.
And that next slide is nominal rates and inflation, tweeted on September 30th.
We've talked about this in the past, right? I've mapped out a very direct link between the fact that interest rates are suppressed at levels below where they should be, and you can see that in this slide, right? So this is the TIPS break-even in the horizontal, a scatter plot against nominal rates in the vertical. That blue line is the intersection of the two, and the dots represent the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and the dot with the numbers in it is where we are right now, and it shows you that yields should be about 100 basis points higher than where they should be. And I've demonstrated, you know, in this webinar in the past, that 100 basis points, when you plug that into the discounted cash flow model, that's 5 PE points. And so if rates were to normalize back to 2 or 2.5, which is not a prediction, I don't think they'll go that high. I think probably 2 will be the ceiling, and then the market will start pricing in maybe a slowdown, and then the Fed kind of has to back off. But, you know, assume for a moment that yields would revert to where they really should be trading based on the TIPS market. That would let some air out of the stock market in terms of the PE ratio, which has expanded by 25%. That's not to say I think the market would fall 25% because there's other things going on. But you can see how the linkage kind of works, and that the taper can set a whole chain reaction in motion.
And I mean, I just come back to that sort of where it should be and the 100 basis points. I mean, there's no doubt that people are talking about this, right? There's sort of this sense of things aren't real in the markets. There are pieces of it that don't quite work. There is some suppression, as you've spoken about, and that chart demonstrates. Just sort of tell people how to keep their belief. Like what is sort of the piece of this? To an extent, you want someone with a steady hand in these markets right now. But this isn't really for the faint of heart, truly. I mean, this is a weird moment.
It's a possible inflection point, right? So if yields are, if the nominal 10-year yield's going to go, let's just say to 2%, for kicks. That's a half percentage point up from here. That should knock the PE down by several points. But remember, if this were to happen a year ago when earnings were not yet carrying the load for the market, that two PE points would be all price, right? I mean, but by definition. But now, you know, earnings are growing 48% this year over last year. Earnings season is about to begin, and the expectations are, again, for about a 25% increase over last year for the third quarter. And so earnings are carrying, you know, the market here. So a drop of, let's say, two or three PE points on a 50 basis point increase in the 10-year yield, maybe that's a 10% correction, maybe it's a 15% correction. I think many stocks are already down that 10, 15%, and I think it's already kind of known, right? I mean, the market doesn't wait for the whites in the eyes unless it comes completely as a shock. So I think a lot of this is already in the market. But again, a PE drop against a rising E means less of a drop in the P, right? So it's always that balance.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I mean, they're obviously incredible opportunities right now, but it's an interesting moment for people who maybe are less informed, you know.
It's right. Tough. And also, I would just add I don't have it here, but when we look at the low from last week, S&P was only down 5% from the highs, but it's nothing, right? I mean, that happens all the time. But if you look at the internals the number of stocks above or below their 50-day moving average, and you look at it by sector, some sectors, especially on the cyclical side of things, on the value side, so materials, industrials, et cetera, they were at very, very depressed levels. And that's, of course, has been the side of the market that has been really just kind of treading water while large cap growth stocks have been going up. So a lot of the correction is already in the market. So I wouldn't want people to like all of a sudden react now saying, let's sell. Like I wouldn't say that anyway, because whenever you sell, you lose the compounding ability. And that is really the secret sauce to investing, is just being in so that you can compound those returns, even knowing that the market goes against you 40% of the time. And so I think a lot of this is already kind of yesterday's news. It's not like the taper is all of a sudden this surprise development. We all saw it coming.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you in particular were showing us sort of what could happen in September. And as we intro, that's exactly what everyone's been experiencing. So it's interesting to get your thoughts. A few questions, lots of questions actually rolling in. So views on energy. I mean, we're certainly seeing Europe be disrupted by the gas story, but overall, I mean, we're seeing crude just tally all the way up close to that, in or around that $80 mark. Is that too high?
It's a good question. I don't have a real clear handle on it, because pre-COVID, if oil went up this much, you know, the shale industry in the U.S., all they would do is open up the valve and pump more oil, and that would be the end of it, right? But a lot of those wells were turned off during COVID, and I'm no oil expert, but my understanding is that when you're talking about shale and fracking, that once you turn a well off, it's hard to turn it back on. like it gets, I don't know, gets clogged up or something. I know there's probably people on this call that know far more about the energy markets than I do, but that's my general understanding. And then, of course, you have this whole issue of distribution, of supply chain disruptions. And you look at shipping rates coming from China, they're just off the charts. So, like we saw with lumber, so many months ago, it wasn't that there wasn't enough lumber. It's just you couldn't get it from point A to point B. And so I think with gas in Europe, it's a lot of the same issue. So so I think they will get resolved over time, but it just shows you just how fragile the whole system was. And then in the U.S., the lack of available labor is obviously a major issue. I mean, it really speaks to the larger inflation narrative, I think, and kind of this capital to labor pendulum that we've talked about in the past. I mean, there are just people who work just kind of, doing the thing, working for $15 an hour because that's what people did. And I think the pandemic just kind of has created a reset where people are like, no, I'm not going to do that for $15 an hour. Pay me $25 an hour. And you're hearing this anecdotally from, contractors, plumbers. Contractors need an extra plumber on a job, and they have to go up to like $27 an hour, where a year ago, 2 years ago, it would have been $20. And so that's a very interesting phenomenon. I don't know to what degree this is playing out in Canada or the rest of the world, but it's certainly playing out in the U.S. And when you look at the jobless ratio, the gap between the unemployment rate and the what's considered natural unemployment rate or full employment, we've shown this chart in the past. At the peak last year during the lockdown, that gap was 10 percentage points. It's down to 1% percentage point, which is still a gap, a much less gap. But if you adjust that for the number of job openings versus job seekers, it's completely reversed and then some. And this is one of the things I think that the Fed is correctly seeing this, right? Because the Fed had been doing this narrative like, we're not going to stop easing until every last person's back at their job. I think they're realizing that that ship has kind of sailed, because the people who are not back at their job are choosing not to be, because they're waiting for the wage pendulum to reset. And I think that does speak to potentially a more structural inflation going forward.
Yeah, really interesting. There's a couple of questions coming in on the wage front, and that's exactly what you were sort of passing through to everyone there. A few questions on cryptocurrencies. One, obviously, is this sort of impact of China and its ban on the cryptocurrency space, different areas of it. There is a whole regulator discussion, probably globally, to fit in there. But what do you think on sort of the digital asset law front? That's a question from one of the advisors joining us here today.
It's a great question. I remain very constructive. I think the regulation that clearly is coming in the U.S. I think will be a good thing, because it will legitimize the asset class, and it will remove or at least reduce one of the unknowns about investing in crypto. One of them is the volatility, too volatile. One of them is the ESG, it's too dirty. One of them is the regulatory risk. So I think when we get that out of the way, I think it will make a lot of people, especially institutional investors, maybe more comfortable that, okay, it's regulated. Now we know what the rules of the game are, right? So I think, you guys already have a few ETFs in Canada. I would be shocked to see an ETF come out in the U.S. Before some regulation is in place, right? Because the SEC will want to make sure that investors have some protection once a retail product will be available. I do think an ETF will be coming, but I think there'll be regulation before that happens. As for China, what China is doing is kind of obvious. It is reining in everything that undermines their ability to control their economy. The digital yuan, the crackdowns on like Alibaba and all these industries. I think it's all about kind of the metaverse and controlling the data and knowing exactly who does what and when and how. And obviously having Bitcoin out there or crypto in general goes against that. I think a big part of this is not really Bitcoin itself, but the stable coins. What the stable coin system looks like, you have kind of the above board ones like Circle in the US, and then you have the Wild West ones like Tether, who are, not US listed, for the lack of a better term. And anecdotally, I've heard that, in the old days, the Chinese would try to get their money out of the country by going to Macau and gambling and kind of getting their money out the door that way. Apparently, Tether is a way to do that now. So it does not surprise me at all that China is like, not so fast, right? It wants to have control over the money and over the activity. So, it's a good test case for Bitcoin if it can survive this and the mining ban and the regulatory risk is already kind of in the price, then it can basically survive anything.
That's so interesting. Yeah, these are great test cases, and it's interesting thinking of it as, just another version of an offshore haven in some way. I mean, I guess we've been talking about that off and on for a while, but it fits well with that. That overall thought. Okay, so thoughts on EM, Jurjen? Here's a question coming in from one of the advisors on emerging markets.
So I still like emerging markets. It's kind of a play on a weaker dollar and maybe on more of a cyclical recovery, right? We can, at least from my perch as a U.S. investor, I can buy U.S. value, financials, energy would be kind of the two obvious ones. But my dilemma is that the mega cap growth machine that drives the U.S. markets is so powerful. The FANG stocks, the big growers that generate a lot of free cash flow and that generate more than they need, and they return the excess back to investors indirectly via share buybacks. That machinery is such a powerful force in the markets, and maybe next week we can talk about that, because I've got some slides, but we don't have enough time for it. But that's a very big driver for this secular bull market, that just kind of the demand for shares from companies buying them back and also buying other companies. So I don't want to bet against that, but how do I play the value side without betting against the growth side? So the way I think of it is it's almost like a barbell, where I've got the U.S. big growers, and then I've got emerging markets as the more value ex-U.S. dollar play. But EM has not performed the way I had expected. Part of that, of course, is China. China weighs pretty heavily in the EM. If you look at the MSCI EM index ex-China, it looks a lot better, but it's easier said than do, right? If we exclude all the things that don't work well, every index is going to look good. So maybe that's not a great way of thinking about it. But I think actively managed EM, I think it still has its place, but emphasis on actively managed, because you do need someone to differentiate an Evergrande from whatever the opposite is of that.
Fascinating. We don't have a whole lot of time for this last question, but I'll just squeak it in if you don't mind. This is on the political front, but really the market impact. So a year to the midterms, is the presidential cycle still a big impact on the markets?
That's a good question. So typically the presidential cycle holds that the first 2 years of a presidential four-year term tend to be subdued. Because the president's cleaning up kind of the mess from the past, and that's not a direct inference to this particular cycle, but generally, new legislation is imposed, and that's not always received well, because generally markets like politicians to keep their hands off, and not regulate. And then the last 2 years, people are just trying to get reelected, and especially in the days before the Fed became independent, that may have also meant more monetary easing as well as fiscal easing. So typically first 2 years below average, last 2 years above average. The last cycle really hasn't played out that way, because as you remember, the Trump administration cut taxes right away in 2017. And so that kind of front loaded a lot of this positive action. And then in this particular term for President Biden, obviously we've had a lot of fiscal stimulus because of the pandemic. So all else equal, that's how it works out. But I think, all else is almost never equal. And I think the current cycle is an example of that.
That's why, thank goodness, you take us through what you think each week and provide us with incredible research that you share. Yuri and Temer, such a pleasure to see you. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again next week. All the best.
Great. Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you next time.